And I'm Victor Gurari from the University of Colorado at Boulder. Well, I work mostly on problems of quantum physics, superconductivity, quantum Hall effect, exotic systems, but I also have some interest in statistical mechanics, and I think this talk has to do with these kind of interests.
Okay, so you can start and you can put like logarithmic scaling, logarithmic correlation, anything.
Okay, well, I'd like to start by thanking Pierre and Greg Huber for inviting me to come here and asking me to talk about this subject. And I also would like to apologize that I cannot stay here for longer. I would much prefer to stay here for longer, but responsibilities at home, teaching, family, other things which you're all familiar with, make it essentially impossible for me to stay beyond today and tomorrow, so I'll be here just for 2 days. And I also would like to start by maybe explaining why I'm going to talk about the subject and what the subject has to do with my work, why I'm the person to talk about logarithmic scaling. So to be honest, I haven't worked on this subject in quite a few years, but I was lucky in the early days of the subject to write one of the first papers on the subject. Basically, the subject wasn't explored until I somehow managed to stumble upon it, and that was in the early 90s. And then I also contributed to that later, around the year 2000, while actually I was here as a postdoc in KITP, and I worked on logarithmic scalings of disorder systems. But since then, there was much work by other people, which goes way beyond what I will tell you about today, and probably I wouldn't be the right person to talk about these recent developments. I'll mention them a little bit, but I will not give you an overview. But as far as the right people who might talk about these recent developments, I think the most prominent of them is Hubert Salleur, who spent maybe the last 10 years developing the whole research program related to logarithmic scalings and statistical mechanics. So some of his recent papers are very interesting, but also very technical and long. Okay, so now what I would like to...
Jesper Jacobsen.
Yeah, by mentioning just Hubert Salleur, I'm to disservice to his collaborators, and Jesper Jacobsen is one of them, like Nick Reed is the other, and then several of the students of Hubert worked on this subject, and I think the latest student who is now a postdoc in Berkeley is Raman Vasseur, who's been working on this. Okay, so this is a list of topics I'd like to go over today, and so when I was preparing this talk, I was also getting some sort of mixed messages from the organizers as far as exactly what I should talk about and how slow I should go, how fast I should go. So I'm going to go pretty slow in the beginning, and I hope you won't blame me for this. I'm sure there are people here who will know more about what I'll say in the very beginning than what I will say and who will be bored with what I'll have to say. But on the other hand, maybe there will be some people here who will find it useful. And so first I'll just discuss logarithmic scaling in the context of randomization group, how these two fit together, in what sense randomization group can lead to logarithmic scaling. I'll give you examples, which I think both of these examples won't require any sophisticated technique to understand. First, 3D random bondizing model. There's an approach to this model, but this model, first of all, does have logarithmic scaling, which wasn't realized for a while, but eventually it was realized. And there's a particular approach to it developed by John Carsey in 1999, which is very elementary, won't require any advanced explanation where these logarithms come from. But then I'll go into the other two subjects. One of them is so-called symplectic fermions, which are related to the determinant of a Laplacian. And the problem of the determinant of Laplacian arises in many contexts. And one of them is the so-called abelian sand pile model, of which there might be bigger experts here than I am. I'm essentially, I mean, I know almost nothing about this model, but I do know that it's related to the determinant of a Laplacian. Maybe that's the only fact about it that I know. And I'll discuss in what sense the determinant of a Laplacian is an example of logarithmic scaling. But I won't tell you how it's useful for a abelian sand pile model. Actually, I would be very happy to hear in the context of what I'll say, in what sense this has anything to do with a abelian sand pile model. And finally, I'll mention the last subject, which is the statistical mechanics models with quench disorder, especially two-dimensional random walks, two-dimensional percolation. And conformal field theory with central charge C equals to zero. So this developed into a big subject. So it turns out all of these models, random multiplication and other two-dimensional statistical mechanics models, which can be thought of as having Quine's disorder, and I'll explain in what sense, they all have logarithms, which precluded the development of the exact description of these models using conformal field theory. And this is the subject to which Huber Salor and his collaborators have contributed extensively over the last few years. But I'll just mention a few things going back to my own work 10 years ago. And I will only mention briefly what Huber did. Okay, so now with this introduction, I can go to the main part of my talk. So I'd like to start with this quote from Wikipedia. Everything these days comes from Wikipedia, or at least it's the easiest to find. So before writing this talk, I looked up what Wikipedia has to say on the subject of critical phenomena. And it says that critical phenomena has to do with critical points, and critical phenomena include scaling and only power law divergences of various quantities, critical exponents, which are these powers of these power laws, and they have something to do with second order phase transitions, although not always. Well, so what I'll tell you today is that sometimes these power law divergences get replaced by logarithms. Just, you know, once you have power laws, you might also have logarithm, because it's just a small correction to what power law means. And you'll see, just on the next slide, how these logarithms come about. Oh, maybe two slides from now. No, next slide, really.
Was that phenomenon known quite a long time ago, if an exponent goes to zero? You often just said that was logarithmic.
Yes, so there is some truth to it. Like, specific heat of two-dimensionalizing model diverges logarithmically, and usually people say it's because corresponding critical exponent is exactly zero. But I think this is slightly different logarithms, though. There's also a second type of logarithm, which is very common. And so I won't mention them here, but let me mention them now to make sure nobody confuses those logarithms with these ones. Anytime you have a critical point with some sort of irrelevant perturbation, so that the model you're studying is actually away from the critical point by that irrelevant perturbation, like spin one-half spin chains, for example, one-dimensional spin chains with spin one-half, they're known to do that. And so then if you look at various correlations, they'll go logarithmically. But that's the result of having irrelevant perturbations. Or a good example is a rising model in four dimensions.
You mean marginally
relevant? Yeah. Oh, yes, marginally relevant. Right. I meant marginally relevant. Rising model in four dimensions, right? Okay. So again, to set the stage, here is the example of critical phenomena, which everybody starts with when they study critical phenomena. Here's an Ising model, spins living on some sort of lattice in two or higher dimensions, interacting via spin-spin interaction. Spin takes values plus minus one. So K is inverse temperature. In the low temperature phase, spins are ordered. In the high temperature phase, spins are disordered. And precisely between low and high temperature phase, there's a critical point, K star. And at that point, spin correlates with a power law with some critical exponent, eta here. Some people call it anomalous critical exponent. And then the, if we're in a high temperature phase, we can observe this correlation length, which diverges as a power law, and this is also a critical exponent, with which critical correlation length diverges. But I'll be interested in studying these critical points where correlations go as power laws. Okay, so that sets the stage. Now let me talk about how logarithmic scaling very naturally arises in the context of a normalization group. So I needed to use some sort of formalism, and I was warned that maybe, and some people here might be experts on this kind of thing, and some people here might actually be doing completely different kind of physics and might not be experts. So I decided to go very slow and just use the definition of renormalization group from this book by John Cardy. I also happen to teach renormalization group this semester, and I've been using this book just last month to explain what the normalization group is, and so this is all very fresh in my mind. What is normalization group? Well, I guess I won't be able to really explain it, but I'll refer to this book. So the way the book defines it, it says, suppose I have a model on some kind of lattice, such as this one, with lattice space in A, and the partition function of this model is a sum over some variables, spin variables sigma, such as variables in the Ising model, of some sort of exponential of minus some energies, which depend on some couplings and depend also on the spins. And now it's often or always maybe possible to rewrite this model as another model which lives on a lattice whose lattice spacing is bigger than the original lattice spacing, and with spins which occupy sort of bigger lattice sites. So for example, I could imagine going from this original lattice to another lattice whose lattice spacing is twice as big, in which case b is 2. And so I kind of erase some of these lines, and now I have bigger spins, which are in some sense equal to 4 original spins of the original model before I erase those lines. And I also need to adjust couplings between the spins to go from couplings k to couplings k prime, and there could be more than one such coupling. In the Ising model, there's only one, but under involution group, you typically generate more couplings, next nearest neighbor coupling, farther couplings between spins. And so couplings will then transform as I go from original spins to these bigger spins occupying a lattice with larger lattice spacing, according to some rules, some equations. So new couplings, k prime alpha, are given as functions of all the original couplings. Well, I hope it resonates, or I don't even know. I mean, the way I feel about this is that if you guys know what I'm talking about, you're like thinking, why is he talking about this? But maybe some of you are sufficiently far from the subject where you don't know what I'm talking about, then you didn't learn anything. And I apologize for this. but I don't even have a choice. I have to set a stage in some sense, and so this will be my stage. Okay, and now at the fixed point of revelation group, the couplings take values where the new couplings obtained after I do this normalization group procedure, they're actually equal to the old couplings. That's the definition of the fixed points. And the normalization group flow in the vicinity of the fixed point can be obtained if I Taylor expand this normalization group equation. So if I compute, if I take my initial couplings close to k star but not quite equal to k star, then so this difference of k prime minus k star can be Taylor expanded in powers of k minus k star. And so the new k prime minus k star is some matrix of derivatives multiplied by the original k minus k star. And so at that point, it's convenient to diagonalize this matrix T alpha beta. And so this will be important in what I will have to say in just a second. So we imagine that this matrix has some sort of eigenvectors, and actually left eigenvectors, as John Carter in his book emphasizes early on, and it has also eigenvalues. And now these eigenvalues should be thought of as the rescaling parameter raised to some power. So you can show this for consistency, since if I rescale twice with some parameter b, that should be equivalent to rescaling once with parameter b squared. These eigenvalues of this t must go as b to the power of y, or y is independent of b, at least if this is exact normalization group transformations. And so once I do that, I can introduce further formalism. So I can define scaling variables, which are some linear combinations of k minus k prime, and the or k minus k star. So the great thing about these scaling variables is that they transform very simply. They just get rescaled with eigenvalues of this matrix T, which is this matrix here. And so, you know, k minus k star gets transformed with this matrix, but this linear combination gets transformed simply by multiplication by b to the power of y. Now, it's also possible to define something we call scaling operators, which is you express your energy as a function of couplings in the vicinity of the critical coupling as something proportional to these deviations of couplings from critical couplings. And these objects here, which are some functions of these variables, original variable sigma, they should be thought of as scaling operators. And so these objects are scaling operators, so these are scaling variables. Y is called the scaling dimension of the scaling variable. And you can also introduce parameters x, which are d minus y, which can be thought of as scaling dimensions of these scaling operators phi. And you can furthermore show that phi must have a correlation function if you calculate it exactly at the critical point, which goes as a power law, and the power is precisely twice x. And the way to show it, actually, is by analyzing how this energy gets transformed under a normalization group. So coefficients y get rescaled by b to the power of y. And if you write down this kind of expression in the continuum notations, you must introduce lattice spacing as you go from summation over lattice sites to integral. So lattice spacing naturally appears, and lattice spacing itself gets rescaled But under normalization group, you want the energy to remain invariant. So that tells you how phi transforms. And so phi has to get rescaled according to this formula here. And so that formula imposes that the correlation function must go like this. Because as you go from, as you do a normalization group transformation, you change lattice spacing, and simultaneously phi changes like that. So in order to match left and right-hand side, and in order to keep phi dimensionless, the correlation function must go as a power law, which goes as 1 over R1 minus R2, that same power. Okay, so that was basically the sort of a content of maybe 4 of my lectures earlier this semester, and I apologize if it sounds so elementary, but on the other hand, maybe it's always good to hear it once again. So that's how a normalization group is applied to study of critical points, such as the critical point in the Ising model. Okay, so what does it have to do with logarithmic scaling? Well, at some point, I introduced this matrix, T alpha beta, and I introduced its left eigenvalues. But the problem, left eigenvectors and left eigenvalues. But the problem is this matrix is generally non-symmetric. There's nothing in this matrix which forces it to be symmetric. So when you have non-symmetric matrices, they're not guaranteed to have nice real eigenvalues. So what if they don't have nice real eigenvalues? So for example, maybe it will have complex eigenvalues. And I think examples of that are unknown, although these are very strange examples. I don't really know how much is understood generally about these kind of examples. But one famous example, I think, goes back to Cardi's work, Cardi Oslund, early 80s. But I'm not going to talk about this. So here is another situation. What if the eigenvalues exist, but they coincide? Maybe I have two coinciding eigenvalues. Now, it's generally known that if a matrix has coinciding eigenvalues, then often it cannot be fully diagonalized. And instead, it can be brought to the so-called Jordan normal form, which I also looked up in Wikipedia. Wikipedia has this nice picture, so I took it from Wikipedia. So, well, I'm sure that everybody here studied linear algebra and know exactly what this is. If you happen to have degenerate eigenvalues, sometimes the best you can do is to bring the matrix into this kind of blocks, which have ones above the diagonal, and this coinciding eigenvalue is below the diagonal. And so that would mean that I should be able to bring this matrix T, perhaps, if it has coinciding eigenvalues, to this kind of form. Notice I don't put 1 here, because generally this matrix T is a function of the scaling parameter in my normalization group. And so this will not necessarily be 1. It'll be a function of this B. And so that means that if I do my normalization group transformations, I'll have two scaling variables, U1 prime and U2 prime. And U1 prime will transform simply by multiplication, just like my scaling variable in my previous slides. But U2 prime will transform as lambda U2 plus mu U1. Mu is this guy, just from the form of this matrix. And so it might not be obvious right now, but this will immediately lead to the logarithmic scaling. And let me show you how that leads to logarithmic scaling. So it's a good idea at this point to go to the infinitesimal normalization group equations, where I choose my B to be e to the power of L. Anybody who did normalization group knows exactly what I'm talking about. And so I'll choose my L to be very small, and I'll study the transformation laws under rescaling with a factor of B as continuous transformations which are functions of L. As L is increasing, my coupling constants change. And as a consequence of what I had in the previous slide, they'll satisfy these normalization group equations. So conventional equations wouldn't have this minus U1 term here, but I have to add this minus U1 as a consequence of the Jordan block structure of my matrix. So it's very easy to integrate these equations and obtain the finite normalization group transformations, which I had on the previous slide without specifying the dependence on the rescaling parameter. And all you need to do is to exponentiate this matrix, Y0 minus 1Y, which I did with Mathematica. And that's what I got. So before, my scaling variables got rescaled by b to the power of y. But now the variable 2 has an additional factor, b to the y logarithm b times u1, just as a consequence of exponentializing this matrix. You could ask me why I chose to put minus 1 here as opposed to plus 1 to keep it precisely what normally is called Jordan normal form. But that's because I wanted to keep plus here. And if it's a minus here, it'll be plus here. In the end of the day, it doesn't matter what number states here. It can always be rescaled to be 1 by but in different examples, and I want to keep this number to be some other value. Important thing is that there is a number which sits in the off-diagonal entry of the, my matrix T, which defines this normalization group transformations. Okay, and now the fact that the energy perturbed by these scaling variables should remain invariant will demand that these two equations are valid. It's very easy to check. If you differentiate that respect to L, you need to have these equations to keep this invariant. And so that also has this kind of Jordan form of transformations. Phi 1 doesn't just get rescaled, it also gets phi 2 added to it. And then it immediately follows from it that invariants under these kind of transformations with A being rescaled like this demands this form of the correlation functions. If I change my lattice spacing A to some spacing A prime, simultaneously phi 1 doesn't just get rescaled, but phi 2 gets added to it. And that gets precisely reflected by the fact that if A gets rescaled by a constant, then logarithm of that constant is a constant, and then this kind of functions get added to my correlation function, which is precisely this correlation function. And that reflects phi 2 being added to phi 1. And so you can convince yourself that the only way you can make this correlation function invariant under all these sets of transformations is by writing this kind of equations. And so that tells me that phi 1 correlates with a logarithm, which is unusual. So I'm precisely at some critical point. I've tuned my coupling constants to be critical. And I discovered there's an object, which I'll call logarithmic operator, whose correlation function goes as a power times logarithm. And so again, this has nothing to do with irrelevant, marginally relevant perturbations or any other kind of similar phenomena. It occurs precisely at the critical point if I have this kind of scaling. And so typically these two objects, phi 1, phi 2, which mix under normalization group transformations, are called logarithmic pair. And the object of this pair which correlates onto logarithm is called logarithmic operator. What's also interesting is that in order to make these equations consistent with this normalization group, you must declare that the other member of the logarithmic pair, which is kind of not a logarithmic operator, it doesn't have logarithms in its correlation functions, but its correlation function must be vanishing. It has to be zero. If it's not zero, if you say, well, if it's not zero, it has to go as that same power law is here, and then it just violates this equation. They won't work. And so that was noticed very early on, that an operator which is paired with a logarithmic operator must have vanishing correlation. And that tells us that problems where this kind of scaling appears must be very special. So for example, in the conventional Ising model, it's very difficult to point out something which identically correlates into zero, which is not zero.
The correlations are just a leading power.
Well, I'm computing the critical point.
Is it really supposed to be both R1 and the last
equation? Oh, this is a typo. I apologize, R2. But doesn't matter, right? This is also zero.
Any R2.
Any R2, yes. So this is a typo. That should be R2 here. I don't know why I wrote R1 there.
If we have a Jordan block of dimension d larger than 2, do we have d minus 1, 0, or 1?
But no, you only have 1, 0, and then you'll have a hierarchy of operators which correlate as logarithm, logarithm square, logarithm cube, and so on.
Okay,
but
so
I think there's only one object.
One.
As far as I remember, actually. Because these are much more complicated structures, I haven't looked at them for a while. So that's from my memory. But it's easy to check. Well, yes, so it's very easy. You just apply these rules and see what comes out. Yes, but I believe there's only going to be 1, 0. And then the rest of the...
It's not a problem that it's 0 when R1 equals R2. Square
here?
Square
one,
square
two, or square two?
Well, depends on you. So here I said it's a typo, so it should be R2.
Yeah, but let's choose it equal to 1.
Yes, so it has to be 0 for all R1 and R2, even when they coincide. And that means that the models in which that happens are not the conventional usual models, like the Ising model, because phi 2 should not be identically 0, because it correlates with phi 1. And so a good example of this kind of behavior is in models with disorder which you study with replicas. So you discover the 0 comes about because this correlate is proportional to the number of replicas, and you have to take number of replicas to 0. There are other examples, but it occurs for other reasons.
This probably goes a little bit back to the question of whether this is totally true in the scaling limit and whether this is the the leading part and whether there are some leading. Yeah.
You know, that's a good question, and actually Hubert Saleur would be a very good person to answer it, because he studied these theories away from scaling limits. He formulated a number of exactly integrable models which have logarithms at the critical point but can be studied everywhere, not just at the critical point. And probably he knows the answer to this question, but I don't think I know the answer to this question right away. So all I know is what happens exactly at the critical point in the scaling limits.
Can you explain, I mean, the equation for U1, they look simple, but on the right-hand side for phi 1, it's a complicated one.
It means
And also the correlation function on the bottom seems complicated for phi 1 and not the simple one.
Well, but these equations look very similar to these ones. I'm not sure what sense they're more complicated.
Well, the so exchange du1 is just y1, but the d phi1 is x phi1 plus so
exchange. Oh, it's just exchange. So this migrated here. Yeah. It was minus u1 here, it was plus phi2 here. I have to admit that I've never worked these equations before, so I've worked them just before coming here, and I noticed if that goes like that, that must go like this. You know, if you want to preserve this form, basically u phi scalar product. And if u transforms like that, look, changing u2 generates u1 phi2, and that gets compensated by changing phi1 into phi2 with opposite sign. That's how that works. Okay, but these equations are even more complicated because, well, you need to produce correlation function, which is such that if you differentiate them with respect to L on both sides by differentiating A also, you get, you know, the same answer on the left or on the right. And you differentiate the left with these rules, and you differentiate the right by just differentiating these guys. And also you use that phi is a dimensionless object, so every time you say an A, you have to insert R1 minus R2 in the denominator to make this ratio dimensionless. Okay, but so once you impose that, you get this kind of correlations, and you cannot avoid having them.
Can you have those x sub zeros coming from a worded entity?
Worded entity. Well, I don't know. Probably not, but I don't know if I can answer this question right away. It's
substantially far about what. Can you have a zero of supersymmetry? Number of Bosons, Manus, Fermions as an overall factor.
Ah, you know what? By mentioning the word supersymmetry, you now connected me with something which I thought about and which I will hopefully mention if I have time. So there are supersymmetric theories where the zero will indeed come as a result of a worded entity. You're absolutely right. In fact, this is one of my later slides. I just thought about it in the wrong way when you first asked this question. So yes, this does happen in some supersymmetric theories as a result of a worded entity. Okay, so I hope that we're done with this slide. Let me go to the next slide, where I'm just asking this rhetoric question. So how common are these logarithmic operators? And you might think, well, you know, I need to fine-tune some eigenvalues of some matrix. They must exactly coincide, and that probably requires something very special. And maybe that doesn't happen very often. But it turns out that it's not exactly true. And that's because typically the eigenvalues of the transfer matrix, they can be fine-tuned. They take some very specific values which are demanded by the theory. And you know, they're related to critical exponents, which people spend ages to calculate. And these critical exponents don't take some arbitrary values and can be randomly tuned any way you want. Typically, they take some fixed values. It may so happen that there is a set of theories where they are coinciding exactly, and those theories will have logarithms. And so it turns out that, yes, logarithmic operators and this kind of coinciding of eigenvalues occurs in a variety of models, and especially a good example are critical models with Quench disorder, which I'll mention. And so let me go with you over a very simple example of three-dimensional random bondizing model, which it turns out it has this kind of correlations. So if you tune it to its critical point, the atomizing model will have correlations which go logarithmically and not just the spiral laws. And I would even say maybe a consequence of this for the physics of real magnets has, I don't think it was explored very much in the literature, although you could argue that maybe it's just a minor correction to what people already know anyway. So let's define what I mean by three-dimensional random bondizing model. So I imagine I formulate the same ising model as before, but now my couplings K, they are random, so every bond has a coupling, and these couplings vary from side to side or from bond to bond. And they're distributed with some Gaussian probability distribution with a strength gamma. And so every delta k on every bond is its own independent random variable. So that defines random bondizing model. And now, this model is studied by using something called replica trick, which I'm sure here there are some people who are experts on this, and some people are truly great experts on this subject, way above my level. And nevertheless, I'll bravely explain what it is to this kind of audience. So to study this model, what I'll do is I'll take this partition function, I raise it to the nth power by replicating it n times. So now each variable occurs n times, and there are n copies of this model. A labels this copy, and everything is summed, or a product of this is taken over A going from 1 to n. And so once the partition function is raised to the nth power, you can average it over disorder for arbitrary n. And averaging over this delta k on every side is very simple. It just squares this operator, which is now summed over replicas. And so you get this double sum over replicas as a result of averaging over this Gaussian distribution. And now the reason you need an nth power, you cannot just average the first power, is because typically you are interested in free energy, for example. And free energy can then be calculated as n goes to zero limit of this partition function. So, or the nth power of the partition function. And so you really need to study then the nth power for arbitrary n. And you need to give a meaning to taking this n to zero at the end of the calculation if you want to calculate quantities having to do with the original random bondizing model. Again, the reason why we're doing this is because in principle, we could have just immediately averaged logarithm of z, but it's just logarithm of z would be very hard to average over these random bonds. While the nth power of z is relatively easy to average, but then the difficulty is shuffled into this limit and goes to zero. Okay, and so what I'd like is briefly discuss what kind of physics this model has, and what I'm about to say is very well known, goes back to the 70s at least, if not before the 70s. In the vicinity of the conventionalizing critical point, the general strength is zero, and k is tuned to some k star, which is the three-dimensionalizing model phase transition. And so close to that point, we can ask whether this perturbation is relevant or irrelevant in the normalization group sense, whether it has, whether its coupling has positive or negative scaling dimension. And so that's very easy to establish. So this operator which couples to delta k is so-called energy operator. It has scaling dimension yt. And let me think. Well, okay, so yt is a scaling dimension of delta k, and xt is a scaling dimension of this operator. And this scaling dimension is very well known as d minus 1 over nu, when nu is the critical exponent defining how correlation length diverges. Now, square of this operator in the presence of these replicas has dimension which is twice as big as this dimension. And so that allows us to compute the scaling dimension of gamma, phi gamma, which is 2 over nu minus d. And whether that gamma grows under the normalization group or decreases depends on whether that scaling dimension is positive or negative. And so that was studied back in the 1970s, I think. So the question is really whether nu is larger than 2 over d or nu is less than 2 over d. This is called Harris criterion. So if nu is larger than 2 over d, then this disorder is irrelevant. And that means we don't need to have disorder. We understand everything as if there is no disorder in this problem. But if nu is less than 2 over d, disorder is relevant. By the way, that's equivalently can be formulated as that the critical exponent alpha, which defines how specific heat diversion is in this Ising model, that critical exponent is positive. And a three-dimensional Ising model happens to be positive. And that means that this disorder is relevant. And so what it really means is that the normalization group flow in the space of disorder strength and coupling, which represent temperature, has actually two critical points. There is a conventional three-dimensional Ising critical point, which everybody knows about, but disorder is relevant away from this point for the three-dimensional Ising model because nu is less than 2 over d. And disorder flows to some other fixed point, gamma star. And so if you have a random bondizing model and if it changes temperature, it does not go through a conventional Ising transition. It actually goes through a different transition, which we can call disorder-dominated critical point. It still looks like a transition. Ising model goes from order to disorder phase, but the critical properties of this transition are different from the conventional three-dimensionalizing model critical properties. And so could well be that there are materials which have this kind of features. By the way, it's important that I don't have any of this spin glass physics here. So my random bones are random, but they all have the same sign. They have a flip in their signs. So just, I could call it weak disorder, critical points. Okay, but now what's interesting, that it was not really understood until 1999 that generic correlations of various objects at that disorder dominated critical points are all logarithmic in the sense which I explained before. And so here is the slide which represents an argument given by John Cardy in 1999, which explains in the most possible, elementary possible way why these correlations go logarithmically. So in fact, at that point, I was working with Andreas Ludwig, already understood that those correlations were logarithmic, except in two dimensions, not in three, and using different methods. But this was a much easier way of seeing this, and also generalizes to arbitrary number of dimensions. So here is the argument. Let's look at the energy operator of the Ising model, which is replicated. So R and R prime represent nearest neighboring sites. And let's look at two physical correlators. One of them is a correlator of energy operator computed in the first replica, and the other is the correlator of the energy operator between the first and the second replica. And so both of these are physically, well, both of these have physical meaning. So those who work with replicas know right away that the first correlator represents of what happens if I take two energy operators physically, compute the correlation function, and then average it over disorder. Let's say compute its correlation function at a fixed particular realization of disorder, and then average it over disorder. While the second correlation function represents what happens if I calculate the average of energy operator for one realization of disorder, multiplied by the second average, well, actually square that average, take that average, multiply it by itself. Well, or maybe not square, because I compute the second average for that same realization of disorder, but at a different point. And then I'll average product of these over disorder. So in one case, I do a thermal average and disorder average on product of two energy operators. On the other hand, I do thermal average at one point of the energy multiplied by the thermal energy at another point independently, and then I average that product over disorder. So this will be given by the correlation between these two replicas. By the way, I don't need to work with replica one and two. I can work with any two replicas because I assume there's no replica symmetry break in here. So I could take replica 1, 3, 2, 3. All these correlators will all be the same. But importantly, these correlators must have n go to 0 limit because this n goes to 0 limit is these two physical objects which I can compute numerically, for example. So these limits must exist and must be finite. But on the other hand, I can give arguments that under normalization group flow, this energy operator, which is replicated, has a replica index, does not get renormalized simply. Namely, I should actually define two objects. One of them is a symmetric combination of all these energy operators, summed over replicas. And the other is sort of like a reducible representation, kind of a traceless combination of this energy operator and symmetric combination in such a way that the sum over A of this thing is zero. And I can give argument that under normalization group transformations, these two objects are normalized differently because they don't have to. I mean, they don't couple to each other because they represent different representations of the permutation group between replicas. And so I would imagine that for a given number of replicas, they'll have two different scaling dimensions at the critical points, x symmetric and x irreducible, which are generally not equal to each other. All right, but then I can do one step further. I can say, let's calculate the correlation function between two symmetric operators. And it's very easy by just substituting what they are in terms of these replicas. And remember that I have replica symmetry. So operator between, well, correlator E1, E2 is the same as correlator E1, E3, E2, E3, and so on. And so instead of writing all these correlators explicitly, I count them together. Just I count how many times they occur, such as correlator 1, 3, 1, 4, 2, 3, and so on. And they occur in minus 1 times in this combination. And so I can convince myself that this correlator goes at this linear combination of these two physical correlators, which both must have good n goes to zero limit, each of these two correlators. But on the other hand, as I argued, this is an object which has its own scaling dimension, so it must go with some power, with the scaling dimension, with some prefactor, which might be a function of n. And that's for symmetric operator. And now, for this irreducible operator, I can also calculate its correlation function by plugging in its definition. And it's a different linear combination of these two objects, two physical objects, that then goes to zero limits. But on the other hand, I gave you an argument that this correlator should go differently from that correlator with its own dimension x reducible, which is a function of n. OK, so I got these two correlators. That's how they behave. And they're related to correlators which have nice limit as n goes to 0. So I can use these two expressions. For example, I could add them together. Did I do this right? Yeah, I hope I did this right, but OK. You're standing in front of the board. You will see if I did this right. So I can add them together, and I can find what the correlation function of, for example, E1, E1 is. And this is what I'll get if I add this. And now this object must have the good limit as n goes to 0. Now, the only way it can have a good limit because of this 1 over n prefactor is if these two conditions are satisfied. So both of these dimensions go to the same limit as n goes to 0. Otherwise, this just blows up because this difference must go to 0 as n goes to 0. If it doesn't go to 0, then 1 over n factor makes it blow up. But I just gave you an argument that is a nice physical correlator which I can compute numerically. OK, but under these conditions, the limit of n goes to 0 can be computed with the help of the L'Hopital rule. And that tells me that I have to differentiate, in particular, these expressions. And as I differentiate, I generate logarithm. And so that's an example of how logarithm gets generated under the replica limit, n goes to 0.
This looks from the difference of the two exponents for story.
What is that? They have different linear order in n, right?
Yeah, well, x, x, I don't know what's the name.
X here.
X here.
They have to have a linear term in n. Otherwise, you
don't have to. Yes. So you have to be able to differentiate these with respect to n. That's what you mean?
Yeah.
Well, it could be quadratic in it.
Okay, in which case logarithm would occur, right? But that would mean probably that this will be 0. Oh, no, there will be some constant terms. Right, yes. It is possible. Right? So you don't have to have logarithms, but generally you will get logarithms.
Is it another question? So E1, E2 or so is it
out? Yes, I think so. Right, E1 and E2 will also have logarithm.
And is it connected properly?
You can actually see this because the difference of this minus that is this, and that does not have logarithms. Yes, so the logarithm must cancel between these two.
So this general for arbitrary operator?
Well, you might worry about what kind of representations they form. So for example, Hubert Salor and his collaborators studied other examples of this phenomena in the Q goes to 1 limit of Potts model, which I'll mention. And so there, you might have to construct more complicated operators because Q goes to 1 and not to 0.
So
if you look at the Q goes to 1 limit of Potts model, for the spin itself, it doesn't occur. But for the, oh, you mean for the spin here? So I think here for the spin, it does occur in this model. Yes. So because spin will, I think, have the same features as far as I understand. Yes, you still can have, subtract the symmetrized combination of spins. OK.
If one does some Martin Singer rules, dynamic formalism, can one reproduce this or?
But so that's usually done in a different context when you have random time-dependent force. Or do you mean?
No, but an equilibrium dynamics.
Martin Singer rules, which drive you to equilibrium dynamics.
Yeah, just one given equation, you get the same thing. You should.
OK, well, you should. Oh, yeah, okay, I understand. You mean if I study disorder by using introducing time dependence, right? Usually because of the Skelders technique, but that would be the classical version of it. Yes, you should be able to see that in that formalism. I actually don't know how to see that in that formalism. I do know how to see it in supersymmetric formalism, which is another formalism used by for studying disorder. So the time-dependent formalism, I don't know right away. Maybe I do, I can't recall right now at this moment. But yes, so that would be a good question. Find out how that behaves. It just that's not yet known. All right. So you see how these logarithms appear, very natural. It's very hard to get rid of them, except as Leon pointed out and Pierre that maybe there's something special about these dimensions, so that doesn't happen. But I think it happens generically. So I chose three-dimensionalizing model because two-dimensionalizing model actually is marginally irrelevant. So that would not be a good example to study in two dimensions. But there are other problems in two dimensions where these logarithms appear. Okay, so here I just listed the features of logarithms, and again, to distinguish them from other sources of logarithms which sometimes occur in critical phenomena. So these logarithms appear directly at the critical point. So what I did on the previous slide had nothing to do with going away from critical point. I stayed at the critical point. I kind of assumed that it exists for arbitrary number of replicas, which may not be true in some models, but in this model it is probably true. And then I just took the limit n goes to zero, and the critical point became in that limit a special logarithmic critical point. So no fine-tuning is needed to get logarithms. No fine-tuning can eliminate them. And it turns out that this is a generic feature of problems with quench disorder of this kind. So this random monizing model is not the only one. And there's one more thing which I wanted to mention, and which I forgot to mention, related to the question Leon asked earlier. So I told you how if you have a logarithmic pair, there has to be an object whose correlation vanishes at the critical points. And here it's very easy to identify that object. It's this asymmetric, because its correlation functions are proportional to n. And so that correlation function vanishes and n goes to zero. And so you can actually convince yourself this is precisely that part of that logarithmic pair in this case. Okay. And so I wanted to go through another example, but I'll go through it very quickly. Two-dimensional percolation, just as an example which was studied in more detail, but I won't go into all the detail of how this was studied, just kind of show the result, because I found that result interesting. So I hope that most people here are familiar with percolation. So it's a model where you have bonds on a square lattice, and these bonds are considered to be on or off with probability p and 1 minus p. And so you kind of throw the dice, and you, but in such a way that the black bond or thick bond comes out with probability p, and with probability 1 minus p, the bond is thin. And then you look at clusters which are formed by thick bonds connected together, and you ask whether there's a cluster which spans the whole system or it doesn't span the whole system. And so it turns out that this particular percolation problem on a square lattice in two dimensions has a critical point at p equals 1 half. So if p is less than 1 half, clusters don't connect from one side of the lattice to the other, and if p is more than 1 half, they all disconnect, and at p equals 1 half, you have critical correlations between clusters. And so it's been known since the 70s that this model can be mapped into q goes to 1 limit of Potts model. So Potts model is a generalization of the Ising model where every variable takes q values. So that sigma variables taking q values, and this is the partition function of this model. And if q is 2, this is literally the Ising model. So there's a standard map from q equals 1 Potts model percolation, which rewrites the partition function at arbitrary q in terms of q to the power of number of such clusters of thick bonds, 1, 2, 3, for example, you form here, times p to the number of bonds which belong to clusters, and 1 minus p to the power of remaining bonds. And you can convince yourself that as q goes to 0, I mean, as q goes to 1, this partition function actually goes to 1, but the correlation functions computed with this formalism give you correlation functions of percolation. So in particular, the spin-spin correlation function essentially gives you the probability that two points belong to the same cluster, which is a question one might want to ask within percolation theory. It's also possible to take q goes to 0 limit in the q-state Potts model and get a different model which counts the number of spanning trees, all possible trees with branches and without loops you can plot on the lattice, which occupy every bond of the lattice. And that problem is related to the Sandpile model, which I'll mention later. But so that would be q goes to 0 limit of this model. But q goes to 1 limit of this model gives us percolation. And so...
By the way, did you intentionally write that it is not to have a second order phase transition in 2D for q between 1 and 4 instead of 0 and 4?
Yeah, good question. No, I think it's 0 to 4. You're right, yes. I wonder why.
Beyond 1, there is something that changes. But still, the fact that there is a second order phase transition, that one should be lost.
Beyond 4, you mean?
Below 1.
Yes, tell you the truth, I haven't really thought about this model at q less than 1. And actually, for the first time, I started thinking about this in this language just as I was preparing this talk. But this model is related to the Oyen-Loop model, and that model is known, you know, how it behaves. But in the limit, n goes to 0, and I think this is equivalent to that model. So, and that model is critical, can be critical. So I think, yes. Yeah, I could put zero here safely without any problem. Okay, so, all right, but so let me think about this Q goes to one limit of this model. And so in that limit, this model was studied a few years ago by Vasseur, Per Jacobsen and Hubert Salur. So they asked this question. They said, well, okay, everybody talks about logarithms. Well, here's a model, percolation, everybody studies. Can we identify the correlator within this model, which I can measure maybe numerically or maybe even experimentally one day if it ever becomes relevant, and which goes logarithmically? So I can verify that that's how it goes. And so but in this Q goes to one limit Potts model, the issue is that the spin operator itself, so it's not logarithmic, you can convince yourself, but the products of spin operators on nearby sites are. And so what these authors showed is that you can consider the following three probabilities. So imagine there are four points, two of which are nearest neighboring points on a lattice, and which are separated by a distance r on this lattice. And you ask for three distinct probabilities. First of all, you ask for a probability that all four points belong to four different clusters. Then you ask for a probability that there is one cluster connecting two of these points, doesn't matter which ones, but the ones separated by distance r. But the other two points belong to two other clusters. And finally, you ask for a probability that one of these points or two of these points belong to one cluster and two of these points belong to the other cluster or to another cluster. And you call these probabilities P0, P1, and P2. Now, you map these probabilities into correlation functions of spins in the Q-state Potts model. And then you convince yourself that this particular linear combination of these probabilities behaves precisely logarithmically in the limit Q goes to 1. So the reason they divided by P2, because I think this combination goes as a Paolo times logarithm, and this ratio is needed to get rid of the Paolo and just keep the logarithm. And so after that, they numerically evaluated this expression on some lattice. Well, here I think they had data for different lattice sizes, and they plotted the data, and they plotted this function. So the parameter theta is, I think, they can determine from here, as far as I understand, so it has to be fitted. But the logarithmic part is fixed with a coefficient 2 square root over 3 over square root of 3 over pi. And as you can see, their numerics lies on this curve. I think I would prefer to see what happens if you just draw a straight line, but like in comparison, but that's what they have in their paper. And so the paper is in the archive in particular. And you can see how they actually established this. But the method is literally the same, all very similar to the one we used for the three-dimensionalizing model with random bonds, to establish that there are logarithms. Okay, so let's see what else I can say in the remaining time. So it depends on how long I should go for. But I can now mention a few more advanced subjects. One of them perhaps may be relevant for those of you who are interested in the sandpile model. So let's look at a problem which involves two fermionic anti-commuting variables with a partition function or with a functional integral defined using this expression. So this functional integral is known to reproduce determinant of a Laplacian. So if I had commuting variables here, it would have been 1 over determinant of the Laplacian. But because I have anti-commuting variables, it gives me just the determinant of the Laplacian. But there is an interesting feature of this mathematical construct, which is, literally speaking, a Laplacian, a determinant of a Laplacian would be 0, because it always has a 0 mode, 0 eigenvalue. And so it's possible in this construction to get rid of the 0 eigenvalue by inserting explicitly theta at some point, theta and theta bar, in this Grassmann integral. So that gets rid of the integration of the, over the 0 mode, and all other modes contribute to give us the determinant of this Laplacian. And so if you stare mathematically at this kind of expression, so you will realize that with at least for some normalization, this means that the expectation value, correlation function of theta of theta bar should be defined as being equal to 1. While correlation function of the identity should be defined as being equal to 0, because correlation function of the identity meaning computing this integral without inserting of theta in theta bar. And so that means that the identity here is a very good candidate for this iterator whose correlation function actually vanishes, because it does vanish. Again, if you don't insert these guys here, this function literally is simply zero. Yes?
Do the r's have to be at the same point? Can it be set of r to the bar of r prime?
No, here they could be at two different points. Right. But it turns out that when they're at the same point, that forms an interesting object, the object which can be identified with a logarithmic operator, and which whose correlation function goes logarithmically. So, okay. So you can, by staring at this functional integral, you can convince yourself that the correlator of identity with itself is still zero, but correlator of identity with this object I tilde, which is this product of theta bar at the same point, will be equal to one. And correlation function of two I tildes will go as minus logarithm times four, although the precise coefficient depends on how you normalize this I tildes, but it's convenient to normalize them in this way. And so that looks like a logarithmic pair. And you can convince yourself actually that it is a logarithmic pair. And so what is actually interesting about this is that if you study a theory of free bosons, by the way, I didn't say that here, but I'm doing determinant of Laplacian in two dimensions. This is all in two dimensions because I want to have this logarithmic correlator. So that should have been written here on the slide. If you study a bosonic functional integral with the same kind of weight but with commuting variables, the correlation function of two bosons also go logarithmically. But usually it's explained away by saying, well, you know, that's not really a conformal invariant correlator. But actually this correlator is conformal invariant. If you say that I tilde is logarithmic operator, so I'll mention this in the next slide when I'll go slightly more into conformal field theory. And so for this kind of model, I tilde is a legitimate conformal operator, conformal invariant, which has this kind of logarithmic correlations. Now, let me see. There is a number of models related to the determinant of delta. So what I told you in the previous slide was just mathematics, some functional integral. But so first of all, a model which counts spanning trees, or q goes to zero limit of Pott's model, is known to be related to the determinant of a Laplacian. And this kind of models are well known. And a particular example which I know about is the example of dense polymers. So it's a model of self-avoiding random walks which live in two dimensions and which go through every side of a lattice. So that model is equivalent to a model of spanning trees, all possible trees without loops, which densely cover a lattice. And number of such spanning trees by Kirchhoff's theorem is known to be equal to the determinant of the Laplacian with zero mode removed. And so dense polymers are related to this functional integral, which I gave on the previous slide. And now, abelian sand pile model is also related to the determinant of the Laplacian. But as I said, I'm not going to discuss abelian sand pile model, because that would take me another half an hour, and I'm definitely not an expert on that model. Okay, but I would like now to go slightly into conformal field theory, and how these logarithms appear within the language of conformal field theory. So in conformal field theory, the stress energy tensor is usually expanded in Lorentz series in powers of the complex coordinate with the coefficients known to be interesting operators which generate conformal transformations. In particular, L0 generates scale transformations. And so what I discussed until now in the context of a normalization group can be reformulated in the context of conformal field theory as that the operator L naught, well, usually when it acts on normal operators, multiplies them by some factor, and that factor is just the scaling dimension of that operator which produces its correlation function. But in logarithmic CFT, again, you have two operators. I call them C and D, kind of phi 1 and phi 2, which I had before, such that L naught multiplies this operator by its dimension, but when it acts on the logarithmic operator, the first operator gets added to the second one. So again, L naught is a Jordan block because of this. And again, you can very easily convince yourself that these three correlation functions must hold true, and they are conformally invariant under full conformal group, and this logarithm itself is conformally invariant. So usually people who study conformal field theory get very, they kind of don't want to believe me. They say, once you have logarithms, you break conformal invariants, but actually these correlations are conformally invariant and consistent with these laws. And so in particular, it's possible to convince yourself that the functional integral I had in the previous slide related to the determinant of the Laplacian is conformal field theory with central charge equal to minus 2, where I and I tilde form a logarithmic pair. So I'll note x and I tilde gives us I, but it's a logarithmic t pair with zero dimension. So the example of this with h being 0, I'll note x on identity is just 0, and I'll note x and I tilde just gives me identity because h is 0. And this correlator, I tilde, gives me minus 2 log z, just according to what I explained on the previous previous slide. One thing which I wanted to mention is I kind of tried to at least refer to my own work. And so here I meant to say that this was first, this kind of discussion first appeared in the work by myself, Chaitan Nayak, and Michael Flohr in 96. That this functional integral gives this logarithmic appearance. But in the context of CFT at central charge minus 2, this operator was identified in my own work in 93, and I think that was the first work where the logarithmic scaling was seriously discussed. Again, so now for those obviously who know conformal field theory, at central charge equal to minus 2, you can construct the Katz table of degenerate operators whose correlation functions can all be computed. And among them, for example, you can identify the operator with dimension 1, which is just d theta in the language of this conformal field theory. And you can identify another operator with dimension minus 1/8. And if you compute its correlation function, it's very easy to see that this correlator or this operator must have the operator product expansion, which has logarithms in it. And that's because the four-point correlation function of this operator will satisfy the differential equation as a consequence of this Katz table. And this differential equation allows us to compute it exactly. So it's related to a particular elliptic function, this hypergeometric function, which becomes elliptic function, I think. And that function is known to go logarithmically for certain axes, which can be matched against the separator product expansion. That is, if you use two sigmas together, you must have a logarithmic operator and identity with a logarithm between them. And it's actually kind of interesting how that works. So if you do a scale transformation, z gets rescaled, which means I tilde gets I added to it, but I tilde itself has I added to it under scale transformation. And they're designed in such a way as to cancel, because on the left-hand side, they don't have any logarithms. It's, they all appear on the right-hand side, and these logarithms get canceled by the appropriate transformation law of I tilde. And so one thing you can say, you can ask is, well, okay, so this I tilde appears as some complicated object within a greater product expansion of some other object, and who knows what this other object is. Doesn't even have anything to do with the determinant of a Laplacian, which I might get if I study a theory with this action, and this partition function is the determinant of a Laplacian. But so it's easy to convince yourself that if you study this theory with antiperiodic boundary conditions for the field theta, and again, those of you who study conformal field theory know that it's very common, you can easily convince yourself that it enforces the operator sigma appearing in the origin at infinity if the boundary conditions for theta and theta bar are antiperiodic. And now, in turn, that sigma has logarithms in their correlation functions and logarithmic operators in their operator product expansion. And now, these kind of observations are relevant, for example, for certain correlations within dense polymer model, which maps into this theory because it has to do with the determinant of a Laplacian. Now, in what ways that may appear in the sand pile model, I don't know, because I've never studied this question, and I would like to ask anybody here if you studied these kind of problems, whether these logarithms play any role or hide anywhere in this within those models. Okay, well, so I have another section. Let me see. Well, okay, so that's what I just said. I have another section talking about C equals zero and problem involving averaging over disorder, in which also involves a little heavier conformal field theory. But I've been talking for about an hour. And so at this point, I should maybe stop and ask you guys if you'd like to hear more, or if I just stop here and not talk about more about conformal field theory about the problems which involve averaging over disorder. Okay, 10 minutes. But okay, but what I will be discussing now will be in the language of conformal field theory mostly. All right, so I have here a slide talking about self-avoiding random walks and why they're related to n goes to zero limit of O(n) model, which some of you might know. So let me go over this quickly. Here's my take on this. Imagine I have self-avoiding random walks. So the part without G generates for me a random walk. The part with G enforces that these random walks don't want to intersect. should be T prime here. T prime is missing. And so, as many people know, the perturbative expansion of the powers of G, which you can just do by expanding the powers of G, can be reproduced by the expanding the this Green's function with inserted imaginary random potential. And so if I now generate that, so I'll be able to rewrite this probability in terms of the correlator within this model, where V is an imaginary random potential, well, I is sitting here explicitly. This would be a Fourier transform of this P of Tx written in this other form. And so that was used by Dejean, I think in early 70s. I actually didn't look the exact date, but I think it's 72, close to 72. To argue that that Salavari random model correlated to n goes to zero limit of O(n) model. So to study this model, you replicate it, then you average it over disorder, and take n to zero. So here, I guess I exchanged taking n to zero and averaging over disorder. But so the end result is this kind of model, many interacting fields phi, n of them, and so in the limit n goes to zero. So if I'd like to study a problem of self-avoiding random walk, I can study instead this kind of field theory with n-component fields in the limit n goes to zero. But now there's another approach to study this model, the supersymmetry approach, which usually often is studied by people studying random potentials in the context of quantum problem, electrons moving in the background of random potential, because this is closely related to the problem of Schrodinger equation and the random potential. If you remove I from here, that would be that problem. And so one way of studying this, as opposed to replicas, is to introduce anti-commuting fields, which are designed to get rid of this denominator, and then average over them, and obtain a supersymmetric theory, which is invariant under some kind of super rotations, as I'll mention later. And so instead of studying n goes to zero replica limit, I can study this kind of theory. That should give me the same physics.
In the previous slide, when you have side by side squared, do you need to split them in order to make them non-zero, or you really have that that time is zero?
My understanding is that actually this is zero. So this is really two terms, not three terms, if you open these brackets. At least I've never seen any contradiction in setting it to zero. But you do have the cross term, and it's important. Right? There's phi bar phi, psi bar psi. If you eliminate the cross term, then you're no longer studying the same model. OK, and so here I have a slide just putting this in context. This kind of supersymmetric effective field theories study, well, they reflect physics of problems with disorder. And a big open question is what kind of critical points such problems have. There's a particular example of two-dimensional quantum Hall transitions, which can be rewritten in terms of a similar supersymmetric or replica quantum field theory, which has a critical point in two dimensions, which in principle should be solvable by methods of conformal field theory or some other methods, but nobody knows how to solve it. And it was an open question for maybe 30 years. For a long time, there was a conjecture for critical exponents, for the value of critical exponents in quantum Hall transitions. But recently, this conjecture was shattered by precise numerics, which showed that the values of critical exponents are actually different from what people thought they were. So the problem remains unsolved. And there is a question, why can't we solve this kind of problems using maybe conformal field theory? But it turns out that these conformal field theories all have logarithms built into the entire structure of these conformal field theories. And how to work with those logarithms is not really understood, although not for lack of attempts to understand. So this supersymmetric theory, well, it's symmetric under rotation in the phi psi space, so a general 2x2 super unitary matrix. Will leave this action invariant. So it's probably safe for me not to mention this, but I will mention it, that in particle physics, there's something else which is called supersymmetry, which I like to call space-time supersymmetry as opposed to isotopic supersymmetry in these models. So that space-time supersymmetry is somewhat different from this supersymmetry, but this could also be called supersymmetry since you're rotating commuting and anti-commuting fields into each other. And now this kind of isotopic supersymmetry I have here, this kind of rotation, it's what's interesting is that products of commuting and anti-commuting fields form in the reducible but indecomposable representations of the superunitary group. So you can convince yourself, for example, that this kind of linear combination of endocommuting and commuting fields, if you apply elements of these unitary rotations or superunitary rotations to them, so this guy goes into here or here, and each of these go into this object. And now this object at the bottom is actually symmetric under these rotations. So you can apply any of the four of these rotations, and this will be, this object will not change. But these objects all go into that object under superunitary rotation. So it's a kind of a strange property of superunitary group. So if I work with unitary group instead, normal unitary group, if these were all commuting variables, these three objects would form a spin one representation of the unitary group. And this would have been a scalar, and it would decouple into two independent representations. But superunitary group somehow fuses them together so that spin one part together with spin zero part forms a representation which can be reduced to the one at the bottom, but cannot be decomposed into two independent representations. And so apparently that's a generic feature of this kind of superunitary groups. And now, it was pointed out by Masarani and Serban in 1996 that any theory which has objects which have this kind of representations very naturally will have logarithmic correlations. And I think that's related to your questions about word identities. So imagine that my C and D are a logarithmic pair. And that's a very natural thing to have. Because first of all, the correlator of two C's must be equal to zero. And that's because if I take a correlator of this zeta object and C and apply to it a superunitary rotation, C is invariant while zeta becomes C. But on the other hand, this correlator should be invariant on the rotation. That's the word identity. So this object must be equal to zero, but on the other hand, that object is equal to this object. And so that means that correlation of CC is zero. So this is the example of zero where somehow bosonic degrees of freedom cancel fermionic degree of freedom, which is maybe the reflection of the replica factor that goes to zero and the number of replicas goes to zero. And so in the same way, you can convince yourself that correlator CD can go as a parallel that is consistent with this kind of identities we have. And finally, correlation DD may go as a logarithm, although that doesn't follow from this because D does not appear as anything under these rotations. You can never get D by doing rotations. You get either zeta, zeta bar, or C, but it can have this correlation. It doesn't contradict anything. And so when you have this kind of indecomposable multiplets, you may get logarithms. And now it was further noticed in the work first by myself and then myself and Andreas Ludwig in 1999. That this actually does happen for theories, in this kind of theories, and not just for some strange correlations. You know, until now, we discussed logarithms which are appearing in some obscure operators, which may or may not have physical realization. But here, it turns out that even the most basic operators of conformal field theory must have logarithmic correlations. So in particular, everybody who studied conformal field theory knows that operator product expansion of two primaries should have a stress energy tensor in it with a coefficient 1 over C in front. So a theory with central charge equal to 0, and all these theories must have central charge equal to 0. So that clearly cannot satisfy this because C is 0. So instead, a new object appears, which I called little t, which has to have this kind of operator product expansion with t, which appears in the expansion of 2a's according to this rule. So it replaces big T. And so you can actually argue that this little t is a part of the indecomposable multiplet of which stress energy tensor is the symmetric part. So stress energy is symmetric, but little t goes into big T under the transformations. And now you could imagine a situation where little t is just a normal non-logarithmic operator. And that actually happens in some models, but in some sense kind of fine-tuned models. But generic models, as it turns out, will have more generic APEs, operator product expansions, which involve big T here, which means little t is actually a logarithmic operator. Turns out that all C equals zero minimal models, for example, have this kind of property, which was overlooked until our work in 1999. And so little t appears, it has logarithmic correlations. And furthermore, if you study this kind of operator product expansions, just by postulating that on this little t, it has this kind of logarithmic operator product expansion. So that means that L0 acts on little t gives us two little t plus big T. So that means it's a logarithmic operator. So you can construct by consistency and associativity all these operator product expansions by only postulating that central charge is 0 and that little t exists and has this OPE. And then these iterative product expansions in all the glory turned out to be automatically invariant under supersymmetry transformations, which you didn't impose to begin with. So kind of logarithms and little t force a supersymmetry on you. And so in particular, this is invariant under these kind of transformations. So if you apply them to all these OPs, they go into each other. So that was our observation. And furthermore, we observed that for the minimal model at t equals to 0, this is the minimal model, and these are iterators which appear in the theory of self-aware and random walks and percolation, for example, some of these iterators. And so they all have logarithms appearing in the right places, which allow us to determine values of b consistent with the existence of these iterators. So this iterator turned out to have b equal to 5 over 6, and these iterators have b equal to minus 5 over 8. And that was established first by us, by myself and Andreas Ludwig, for a few of these iterators, and then shown to be true for all of these by a student of Andreas Ludwig, Momo Zhang, who subsequently left physics. And so it wasn't very good move for his career, but it took him a while. He's actually been in Syracuse for a while. It was a while ago. Well, it's not really understood. So, if you wish, and actually you can reinterpret this in a replica sense. So these values have to do with a field whose dimension, if you go away from c equals 0 limit, its dimension is no longer 2, but it becomes 2. And so it kind of becomes the generalized stress energy tensor at c equal to 0. And it turns out that this 2 is such that if you study how its dimension changes as you take c away from 0, it produces b equal to 5 over 6. And this 2 produces b equal to minus 5 over 8. And so for a while, we thought that these two values correspond to theories of percolation and polymers, so self-avoiding random walks. And that was subsequently shown to be true, but only somehow at the boundary of these theories and with b exchanged. So we had a conjecture, what b is for polymer and what b is for percolation. So it turns out the correct value is the other way around. But furthermore, as was shown relatively recently, somehow in the bulk of this theory is b is minus 5. And this was the subject of this paper by Hubert Salleur and his collaborators. And so it's a quite a study, so I'm not going to show what's in that paper, because I would say maybe the most interesting part where they prove that b is equal to minus 5 is discussed in one tiny paragraph, which without ever talking to them, you don't really understand where this comes from, except they identified another operator with dimension 2, which becomes known to as c goes away from 0, and they claim that was the right operator to compute b. And so somehow that b, which is sort of replacement for central charge when central charge is 0, happens to be minus 5 in the bulk, but it's actually minus 5 over 8 and 5 over 6 at the boundary, depending whether you're studying percolation of polymers. So that's these values which they calculated. So these two are at the boundary, and this is in the bulk. And now, this is just one paper in a series of many papers which Hubert Salleur wrote over recent years. So I just went to the archive and pulled up his recent papers. And the only condition I put in that is that they were written in collaboration with Nick Reed. So these are all the papers written in collaboration with Nick Reed over the last 3 years. And all of them, despite what they see in the title, is on exactly the same subject. So GL11 spin chain is a supersymmetric spin chain known to be equivalent to percolation in some limit. And so what they're trying to do is they're trying to understand where these logarithms come from, what kind of structure conformal field theory has once the central charge is 0. They try to go away from the continuum limits and study the theory away from the critical point even, or away from the scaling limits, and understand whether there is some, and this model happens to be integrable, so it has some structure which becomes logarithms at the critical point. So they're trying to understand the structure. Now, the big goal ultimately is to construct somehow their theory of the logarithmic conformal field theory at central charge equal to 0, which involves not just polymers and percolation, but also all other possible theories with Quasi disorder you can think of, maybe even the ones which includes quantum Hall transitions. But this wasn't achieved, and it turns out that even understanding this particular spin chain, which is this logarithmic CFT, is very difficult. If you look at any of these papers, I mean, they're 69 pages, 44 pages, 69 pages, 44, 42 pages. So they're big, and it's not possible, at least for me, to quickly just discuss exactly what they did in that paper. There was a lot of stuff, mostly on classifying various representations of symmetries they have in this model and relating them to the Jordan block structure, which you get at C equals to zero. Okay, so then I'm coming to my conclusions. So what did I tell you today about? So first of all, logarithmic scaling at certain critical points are unavoidable. These are special critical points. You will not see logarithmic scaling in a usual Einstein model, for example. But you will see logarithmic scalings in models with quench disorder, for example. So there are some problems, such as the problem of the determinant of a Laplacian, where logarithmic scaling appears in some operators, which you may want to introduce depending on the physics of the problem you want to study. So maybe there are some objects whose correlators behave logarithmically, and you'd like to calculate these objects. But otherwise, it's the determinant of a Laplacian, which it's a simple functional integral. It's a non-interaction field theory. So from purely field theory perspective, should be a simple model. It's just that there are complicated objects hidden within that model whose correlation goes logarithmically. But some models are such that the entire structure of the model, things like stress energy tensor itself, starts acquiring those logarithms in its correlation functions. And this is the existence of such models is the reason why two-dimensional conformal field theories for interesting problems, which are known to have logarithms at their critical points, so these problems were not solved, and these conformal field theories were not solved, because nobody understands how to fully classify logarithms within conformal field theory, even though without logarithms, it's more or less classified. And so that remains an open question, and it's a subject of many papers, not just of the authors I've mentioned, but many others, and including some people who work on the mathematical structure of such conformal field theories and work in the language of category theory, which goes way beyond what I know and understand. But clearly that subject is developing. And maybe it will arrive somewhere. And from my perspective, I would like to see the solution of logarithmic conformal field theories which produce for us critical exponents for interesting disordered problems. But let me stop here.
Questions?
Beautiful talk. Nice synopsis. You mentioned something about the quantum Hall transition. Can you say any more about the connection between the numerics there and, well, what you said was that the numerics disproved certain conjectures. But I'm a little suspect, because if the numerics don't take into account the presence of logarithmic, possible logarithms, then the numerics can be very misleading. So,
well, that's a good question. I mean, logarithms, even if they're present, that would be a small correction. And what they literally study is the correlation length as they approach quantum Hall plateau transition and how it diverges. I would imagine that there's logarithms, even only because there's probably, well, okay, there has to be marginally relevant perturbations for that to be true. So maybe there are no logarithms there, but there are definitely sublimiting powers they have to treat, right? Not just logarithms. And so my guess would be that these people are good enough to get rid of all of this and just really see the pure power, or to extract what that power is. So somebody whose work I'm familiar with is Keith Slevin, who studied this problem for years, and so his latest results, which I think are consistent with the results of other people who also studied this problem recently, that so the critical exponent nu for quantum Hall transitions was believed for years to be 7/3, which is roughly 2.333, right? But they now believe that it's definitely above 2.6.
Okay.
And then the error bars, something like 2.63 perhaps. So that's not 7/3.
So all of these speculations that related 7/3 to the ratio of 7/4 and
was 4/3. So the critical exponent in percolation is 4/3.
Right. Well, that
some early claims it's 4/3+1.
Yeah.
Back in
the
80s. So that presumably is not right. There are some other somewhat outlandish claims that this critical exponent is actually some irrational number, which is some combination of gamma functions. And if you evaluate that, somehow that comes out to be close to 2.6. But those claims are, you know, it's hard to verify the validity of those claims. But so from what I hear from the people who do numerics, they're fairly confident that the power cannot be below 2.6.
Is there any established
So if quantities are like which doesn't follow the others.
Well, theories with quench, but how about self-avoiding random walks, which maps into quench disorder?
It was
just strange imaginary disorder, right?
Yeah,
or you are talking specifically about quantum problem with quench disorder?
Well, it's really quench disorder.
Really, no imaginary.
Not imaginary, real disorder. Well, I mean, if you depends on how you introduce the disorder. So if you want to study quantum mechanics or a problem of a quantum particle moving in disordered potential, then so first of all, there's quantum Hall transition, obviously. You may argue that maybe it's not conformally invariant at the critical point. But maybe there is no direct proof. The question would be, then why this conformal invariance would be broken. I think my belief is that it's not broken, but correlation functions do have logarithms, but because you have logarithmic operators. I can even give arguments why the specific sigma model which describes quantum Hall transitions must have this kind of logarithms. Definitely its fields belong to this kind of indecomposable representations, because that same type of supersymmetry appears within those sigma models. Now, I don't know for sure that this model is conformally invariant. Maybe something really drastic happens there and conformal invariance gets broken. But I do know a generalization of quantum Hall transitions to a particle with spin, which was studied by Andreas Ludwig, Nick Reed, and their collaborators over 10 years ago, in which they showed to be equivalent to percolation. And percolation, I think everybody agrees that it's conformally invariant. And you can also write it as a similar type of sigma model, just the kind of sigma model that you can solve, or at least map it into percolation, at least the sigma model for quantum Hall plateau transitions. So you could say maybe there's something special about quantum Hall plateau transitions which makes it non-conformally invariant. But I would say it's more likely it's just a more complicated model. And since we don't understand how to study C equals zero CFTs with logarithms, generally, with the exception of some understanding of polymers and percolation, because that sigma model is easier, so people understand it more. So because of that, I would say it's more likely just that more work is needed to understand that problem. But that problem is conformally invariant, but it does have logarithms.
Questions?
Are there kind of generic examples of this phenomenon in unitary theories, or is that prohibited?
So I actually think that in unitary theory, this is not allowed, and that's because at least in the language of CFTs, I have, I think, a solid argument, which everybody agrees with, but maybe there are some exceptions beyond two dimensions, which I don't completely understand. But in 2D, you can think of L0, the operator which generates dilatations, as a Hamiltonian, if you work in the appropriate reference frame. And L0 is non-Hermitian, obviously, if it has a Jordan block structure. So that means your theory should be non-unitary. It's probably true generally. I just want to qualify this by saying that maybe there's something I'm missing here. But, so because of that, at least in two dimensions, I believe that all theories which have this kind of logarithmic correlators must be non-unitary in some way. And in particular, these supersymmetric theories or n goes to zero limits of theories, they all happen to be non-unitary and have non-positive Boltzmann weights.
Maybe there was another question.
Maybe a comment on what you were saying was, cannot this be looked at from the fact that there is this special operator with field operation fashion?
But that would be an argument why the theory cannot be unitary, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so probably. It does sound very reasonable, right? Because you need to have an object which correlates with itself into zero, exactly, but correlates with other things to something which is non-zero.
And so with positive Boltzmann weights.
Yeah, with positive Boltzmann weights, right. So that's probably impossible.
So may I go to my question for you? This was the comment. So we said that with a randomization group approach, we would only see these DC pairs or larger blocks. But with a supersymmetric approach, we see that these DC points are 2 out of 4 of this kind of...
Oh no, you can have bigger blocks too. It was just the simplest example. There are bigger... reducible but indecomposable representations. Actually, you can embed that representation into something bigger, and it kind of goes on forever. So there are, it's possible to have bigger blocks.
Is it true that RG is not seeing this zeta zeta bar, which maybe even if they are there in the theory?
But why? In what sense RG is not seeing zeta zeta bar? I think it's there.
So they would be there. It's not that they are okay.
Well, I think they're there. I mean, these are legitimate objects which are part of your theory to calculate the correlations numerically on some in some other way.
So you were only finding the bosonic quantities, and those which are fermionic were not there when you do the generalization of the normalization matrix. I probably
wrong. Well, there should be states in the theory which correspond to fermionic operators. So it should be fermionic sector in the theory, not just bosonic sector. Yeah, I guess I have limited experience with what you're referring to, so maybe I'm missing something. But
I'm not referring to something specific. I deduced that from your talk, that I thought that the very same C and D for which you were finding logarithms, one approach that was a symmetric approach, was explained by them being the top and bottom point of the square.
Uh-huh, right.
And then you say, no, if you properly do the normalization book, you find the four of them straight on.
Yes, so I understand the first half of you said, but I don't understand the very last sentence. I don't know, so maybe just some misunderstanding about what I said. Let me look at this example. So there are four fields here, mm-hmm. and all four of them are part of your theory. I can actually define for you what they are in terms of basic fields of the theory. And, well, at least, okay. I can define them in terms of basic fields in case of non-interactive supersymmetric theory, which I can just solve. Not a very difficult theory. In other words, the theory without this, if I decide to study a theory with this order, but I'm set this order to zero, but keep supersymmetric, then I know what these guys are. And they still form this kind of multiplet, and these are parts of this multiplet. You have to have them around if you want to understand what's going on. But these guys, psi and psi bar, they're non-logarithmic. It's this top part which can be logarithmic. And actually is logarithmic. So I think I have it.
Oh, okay.
Slide. Oh, maybe here. So yes, but notice they appear. So where do the logarithms appear? Every time you see a log, you will see a little t somewhere. So if I compute a period product expansion of two little t's, well, there are logs on the right-hand side, but little t is logarithmic. When I compute a period product expansion of xi's, I also see a log. But that's this common thing. So two conventional primaries in the presence of logs on the right-hand side always gives you a combination of logarithmic pair with a logarithm multiplying a non-logarithmic partner, because under scale transformation, logarithm generates a constant added to it, but little t generates big t added to it, and this is done in such a way as to cancel each other. And so this remains invariant in the scale transformations, while this thing is just doing conventional thing, non-logarithmic thing on the left-hand side.
Okay, last question.
The q goes to one Potts model that you mentioned, the percolation, the two dimensions. Every percolation cluster can be decomposed into a set of multiply connected regions and singly connected bonds, red bonds and the blobs. So the blobs have the complicated scaling behavior that isn't captured by the usual, that isn't in the Katz table, for instance, as far as I know. Do you have any comments about the logarithmic structure in these multiply connected regions? Because I suspect it's there based on the bad numerics people have. The best numerics are, you can find comments in the literature about how poorly convergent the structure of, you know, the numerical study of these blobs is. So,
well, one thing I do know is that if there's a logarithmic t in the theory, any correlator, any primary operators must have logarithms in the iterator product functions as a consequence of this little t appearing in the iterator product expansions. And so I would imagine that all correlation functions, well, okay, all correlation functions beyond two-point functions will have logarithms. So two-point functions may or may not have logarithms, depending on which operator you're looking at, logarithmic or non-logarithmic. higher correlation functions will have built logarithms in them. But I don't know whether that helps explain. Well, okay, so the best person actually to give a precise answer to this question would be Hubert Seller. I'm sure knows, if he doesn't know the answer to this question, he knows the best known answer to this question.
Why is he here? Why does he need to be here? Okay, I think we have time for that.